Well, this is Jeff Oswald at Concordia Seminary back again for another session of Acts at Lectionary at Lunch. The reading for the sixth Sunday of Easter is a shorter passage than the two previous ones we looked at together. This from Acts 16, verses 9 through 15. In Acts 16, you can guess we're now in the second half of the book. The Jerusalem Council has happened, and from that midpoint on, Luke will follow Paul as his main character rather than Peter. And so we're going to actually see some things very similar in this section from Acts 16 to what we saw with Peter in Acts 10 and 11, but now moving forward with Paul into the full scale, the ever-broadening Gentile mission. In his brief summary of the passage, Fitzmyer writes that this episode stresses the Spirit-guided ministry of Paul as he's prevented from swerving either to the right or to the left and eventually arrives at the important seaport town of Troas. There, Paul learns in a dream that he's to carry his testimony to Greece, a very important part of the Mediterranean world of his day. Come over to Macedonia and help us, the man in the dream tells Paul. In response to that invitation, Paul begins the evangelization of Europe. I've often noted in Bible classes that I think all of us who are of European descent should feel something very special and exciting is happening here as the gospel reaches European soil. We pick up the passage in verse 9, which is not a real paragraph beginning according to the Nestle-Aulin text, but it's enough to introduce what's going to follow. Luke has been telling us about Paul's travels and his traveling companions, and actually we'll see in a very special way that a new companion is added to the team. Beginning at verse 9 then, Kai horama diates nyktos to paulo ofthe. And a dream, a horama. Luke uses this word a lot in Acts. It appears outside of that only in the dream that appears to Joseph that Matthew records. But a dream, then ofthe, from horao, in the passive, is seen by, or here without the agency expressed, then appears. In an intransitive sense, appears in the dative to Paulo, to Paul, diates nyktos, giving the time within which that happens, sometime during the night, at night. Paul has a night vision or a dream, aner makadon tis, ein hestos kai parakalon auton kai legon. So a man, a Macedonian man, and then tis, the indefinite one, a certain Macedonian man, ein, was, and then you see three participles, hestos from histemi, here in the perfect active. So a man was then standing, and parakalon in the present of parakaleo, inviting or summoning him, that is Paul, kai legon, and saying. Barrett notes, this gives a kind of vividness to the description to use ein with these three participles then, which here are in more of an adjectival kind of role. What does the man say? Diabas, from diabino, come over. That is, come over the body of water separating them. Eis Macedonion, into Macedonia. Bo eithezon hemin, and help us, come to our aid. I noticed in one of the commentaries, they thought that this was a rather general verb, to come and help, but perhaps it reflects the sense of the Macedonian situation in need of help, but not really knowing what kind of help Paul could offer. So not reflecting a knowledge of the gospel and asking for that, but simply for the help that Paul can bring. There have been a lot of discussion on how Paul would have known that this man was from Macedonia, and I thought the two perhaps most helpful comments were one by Barrett, who said, in a dream, one knows this kind of thing. That is, Paul himself may not have known exactly why he woke up realizing Macedonia had summoned them. On the other hand, certainly more obvious is that he asked them to come to Macedonia. So there's no real kind of secret here, no need to have elaborate theories about the way the man was dressed or what kind of accent he might have used. A man appears and he summons Paul to come help Macedonia with the saving gospel. Okay, then verse 10. Hos de, hos here used as a temporal conjunction, and with the aorist eiden, we translate it, but when or but after, eiden he saw, the horama, the vision, eutheos, adverb of euthys, he at once, or not, excuse me, not he, but immediately or at once, enze tesamen. And here, for the first time in the text that most of us work with, we see the first person plural of the so-called we passages in Acts. So remember, this is happening in Troas. Now suddenly, instead of the narrator telling us the story in third-person verb forms, they did this or he did that, we see the we form, and sort of common consensus throughout the history of the church has been that at this point, Luke joins the party and now narrates events in which he is a participant. So after Paul, that is, he saw the vision, we immediately, ed zetesamen, from zeteo, set about, desired, wished for, made efforts to exelthane, to go out or depart from exerchomai, eis Macedonion, into Macedonia. Sim bibadzontes, from sim bibadzo, which has as a sort of basic etymological meaning to cause things to come or go together. And it has a few more figurative meanings then. And in this case, it means something like conclude, to draw an inference from all the information or data that you have to come to the following conclusion. And that conclusion is given then with haughty. So we immediately set to work to depart to Macedonia, concluding that pros kekletai hemas hothaos, that God, pros kaleo, was calling us in the accusative, euangelidsasthai autus, that God was calling or summoning us to evangelize them, to proclaim the gospel to them. Okay, so that's really the introduction to the first of a series of episodes of things that happen to Paul and his co-workers then when they arrive in Macedonia. On ekthentos, continuing then in verse 11, we're from on ago, which really means to be taken up, here used in a technical sense for putting out to sea. We, too, will talk about the high seas. If you look at the sea from the horizon, you see the sort of the curve, which actually makes it look higher than you are on the shore. And so this was the very specific word used for going out to sea. So set out to sea, apa, Troados, from Troas, or the Troad region, probably here the city of Alexandria, Troas, euthydramesamen, a word that is used again for sea voyages, setting a straight course, and here again in the first person plural, aorist, we set a straight course to Samothracane, to Samothrace, a small island in the northern part of the Aegean Sea. Te de epiuse, supply hemura, excuse me, on the following day to Neon Pollen, the new city, Neapolis. Neapolis served as the harbor or port for Philippi, which was a little bit farther inland. So when they reach Neapolis, they have actually then made, touched ground in Europe, we can say. Continuing then with verse 12, Cacaethan es Philippus, hetis esten protes meridas tes Macedonias polis colonia. This verse is the most textually difficult, and you can see a number of variants, and even the reading that many people adopt is a conjecture based on some of the later versions rather than a reading that's actually found in any of the Greek manuscripts. The sense seems to be fairly clear, and if you give Luke the benefit of the doubt, I don't think there's a need to sort of worry about this too much. But Cacaethan es Philippus, so, and from there, that is from Neapolis, to Philippi, their final destination, at least on this leg of the journey. Hetis esten, so Philippi, which is, now is it prote or protes meridas, tes Macedonias polas. There's some debate. Is Luke trying to say that Philippi is the capital city of Macedonia or one of the districts? That was not the case. But there are other things this could mean, and protes in the sense of a leading city, not necessarily the capital city, but a leading city of a part of Macedonia or this part, this region. Again, not necessarily a distinct political division, but Philippi was a leading city of this part of Macedonia. And finally, Luke describes it as a colonia, that is a colony with very distinctive rights in the Roman imperial system, autonomous, free from taxation, and so on. So, again, without necessarily trying to force Luke to be more technical here than he's trying to be, he simply mentions Philippi as an important city. Some have conjectured that he spends so many words describing Philippi because it was his hometown. There's no evidence for that. Luke does remain in Philippi as the team moves on, so he clearly had a connection with the city. Then continuing with the text, Amen de en taute te pole diatribontes hemeras tenas. So we were in this city, diatribontes from diatribo, simply means to spend time or remain in a place, hemeras tenas. Tenas here in the sense of several, or how we might say for some days, an indefinite period of less than many days, and certainly not the years that Paul remained in some locations. Okay, continuing in 13. te te hemeraton sabbaton, and on the day of the Sabbath. And notice that even though Sabbath is plural here, it refers to a particular Sabbath day, and plurals were common for festival kinds of days, and the Sabbath could be included here, but there also seems to have been some question about what declension are we really working in when the word moved from Hebrew to Greek. But in any case, it's common New Testament usage, and the meaning is clear enough. So, on a Sabbath day, ex eothomen exo tes pules para potaman hu enomidzomen prosuchein enai. So, on the Sabbath day, we went out, ex eothomen from ex erchomai, we went out of the gate, that is, out of the city proper, para potaman, to the side of the river or alongside the river, who, and here in the sense of where, and enomidzomen, we supposed or we thought, and then notice this is followed by an infinitive and accusative subject, we thought a place of prayer to be. Prosuchein is not just the prayer itself, but was also commonly used for a place of prayer, sometimes for a synagogue, but sometimes for a less formal place of gathering. Kai kathisantes elalumen tais sin elthusais gunaixen. So, and sitting down, taking our seats, elalumen, we were speaking to the women, gunaixin from gunai, gunaikos, sun el thuzais, here in the intransitive sense of women who had come together, assembled as a group, or gathered. So, to the women who gathered there. Verse 14, kaitus gunai onamati Lydia. And there was a certain woman. Remember that tis, the indefinite pronoun, has only two sets of endings, so the masculine and feminine look the same. So a woman, onamati by name, Lydia. And interestingly, her name corresponds to the land from which she comes. We'll find out she's from Thyatira, which is in a district called Lydia in Asia Minor. The language here doesn't make it very clear if she is a traveling businesswoman or if she is, in this one sense, an expatriate. That is, she's resettled in Philippi and there owns her business. You can see that's not really important for the story Luke wants to tell. So she originally comes from Thyatira. Some have said Lydia may just mean a Lydian woman, but there's plenty of evidence that Lydia already at this time was a fairly common first name for women of various social classes as well. So her name is Lydia, Porphyropolis, Poleos Theateron. Let's take these one at a time. So Porphyropolis, a seller of purple, really, a dealer in purple things. And the purple things she deals in would have been cloth and wool or other cloth dyed purple. And this was known to have been one of the main products, one of the main industries in Thyatira. Now, the Greek word for purple, porphyra, actually is the name of a shellfish that was then used to produce a purple dye for a very sort of coveted, richly colored, deep purple cloth. This word, however, could describe other kinds of cloth, not necessarily dyed with the shellfish kind of dye. And it was common in Thyatira to create a dye from a plant, the madder plant, which created a color that in later times was known as Turkey Red, so a deep red color from Asia Minor. Either way, she deals in this imported, dyed, and well-known cloth then from Thyatira. Sebomene ton theon. And from Sebo in the middle, present middle participle. So she was also one who showed piety toward, who feared, or who worshipped God. And here, of course, this would mean the one true God, and could mean that she was what's often been referred to as a God-fearer, a sort of unofficial or Gentile member of the synagogue. But it can also denote anyone who has come to learn of the true God and devotes his or her life to God. But clearly, this gathering is a place of prayer for people who are going to offer prayers to the God of the Bible. A kuin, from akuo, so she was listening. And then heis ha kyrios, whose, is the genitive of the relative pronoun. So whose, and then tein kardion, whose heart, ha kyrios di enoixen, whose heart the Lord opened. This phrase of opening hearts might remind us immediately of Luke 24, but the wording there is actually open their minds, the nous, which can be almost a synonym for cardia. But the exact phrase we have here occurs already back in 2 Maccabees, in a wish that God might open people's hearts to his law and his ordinances. So here it was a common way to express sort of openness, receptivity to the word of God. So opened her heart, pros echein. Here Bruce explains this as an apexegetic infinitive. God's purpose isn't that he might receive or pay attention to or grasp, but he opens her heart, that is, with respect to her being able to do that. So opened her heart to listen attentively. Some say this even here means accept in the sense of believe. Tois lalumenois. What was being spoken? Hippa, here the agent then of the passive participle. What was the things that were being spoken by Paul? Okay, and then verse 15. Hoste ebaptiste kai ha oikos autes. So Luke almost sort of skips a step. He goes straight from her heart being opened to then after the fact of her baptism, simply taking it for granted that one who comes to faith in the word proclaimed then would receive baptism. So in 15, again, hos as that temporal conjunction, but after she was baptized, and then kai ha oikos autes, and her household, par ekalesan legusa, she invited, again from para kaleo, no object given here, but clearly Paul and his companions invited them, legusa, saying, a kekrikate me pistein to kirio enai. So a if kekrikate from krino in the perfect indicative active, second plural, if you all judge with accusative and infinitive, judge me to be or consider me to be pistein to kirio. Here, pistos in the adjective, faithful or believing. If you judge me to be faithful to the Lord or a believer in the Lord, eis elthontes, eis ton oikon mu menete. Entering into my house, remain. That is, come into my house and stay with me. Kai parabiasata hemas. Parabiadzomai, here in the sense of urging someone strongly, or translated prevail upon. She presented a good argument and we couldn't say no. It's that kind of idea. So she prevailed upon hemas us. So throughout this section from Troas now all the way sort of into Lydia's home, you see Luke using the first person plural to narrate the story. So we end this opening episode of Paul's time in Philippi with Paul and his companions staying in the house of Lydia. So then once again we have Jewish Christians accepting the hospitality of a Gentile Christian host. So this is where I mentioned we would see some strong similarities to Peter and Cornelius. So Paul is doing just what Peter had done in proclaiming the gospel, and when it's, although the events leading up to that proclaiming the gospel are certainly different, the result is the same, that the gospel is heard and believed, and then in turn, hospitality is offered to the one who brought the good news. It's not too hard to see how this continues along the storyline of Acts, which we haven't exactly been following chronologically in this Easter season. But certainly as the gospel goes out in different directions and encompassing more and more kinds of people, it's not hard at all to think of some themes here that would make a very nice message from this text. As I was looking through some background material, I came across the actual symbol for Lydia. She has her own coat of arms in Christian symbolic art. It's an interesting little pattern with a baptismal shell poised over a snail. Certainly the snail is to symbolize the purple of the cloth that she sold. But snails also remind us of a steady forward progress. And though we may not want to say the gospel was moving forward at a snail's pace, moving forward, it certainly was. More importantly, the theme that's stressed throughout here is the one that Fitzmyer mentioned in the opening comment I shared with you of the Spirit-guided ministry here. The direction and destinations are chosen by the Spirit and delivered to Paul in a way that couldn't be confused with his own decisions based on either convenience or his appraisal of opportunity. And even in the case then of the message itself proclaimed, notice that it's Lydia who hears, but it's the Lord who opens her heart. So in terms of getting the message there and getting the message within, the stress is continually on God at work. And this is an important Easter theme as well, certainly. It's easy to see why it's such an emphasis in the book of Acts when people think that perhaps God is gone, that Jesus, when he ascended, left us alone and left us to do the work. That simply is not the case, as Luke stresses again and again, as the apostles witness the Lord at work in their midst, in opening hearts, winning people for the gospel, and then actually providing them with community, with a church now on European soil. Well, I thank you for your attention once again, and hope you've been enjoying these passages from Acts as much as I have.